Hello there, inmates. This is Darian from the Regular Old Padded Room Podcast. Got a little bit of a surprise for you here. I talked before about how our little network is growing and expanding and all the different shows that we're bringing you. And I've been talking to a lot of people and a lot of other podcasts about coming on board, but there's one that I haven't mentioned yet. And I haven't brought this one up because we weren't sure about a timeline or how or when it was going to come out or even if it was going to come out, but it's here now, and it is my deep pleasure and honor. That sounded gross. It is not a deep pleasure. That sounds weird. I am tremendously honored to present to you our very own Padded Room royalty, Sarah Nerwinski, GP's daughter, with her new podcast, Dark History, an exploration of criminal psychology. I'm going to quit flapping my gums now and let Sarah take it away. Enjoy the
Welcome
show.
Welcome to the pilot episode of Dark History. Here we talk about what you don't necessarily learn in the classrooms, the very bad things that have happened in the past. Today's episode is on Ted Bundy, one of the most notorious serial killers. Who was he and what did he do? Today I have here with me social studies teacher Susan Coles and psychology teacher Rodney Jensen.
Thank you for having us. Ted Bundy is certainly one of the worst American serial killers, kidnappers, rapists, burglars, and necrophiles that the United States has ever seen. When doing some research on him, I learned that he was born Theodore Robert Bundy on November 24th, 1946. Even the very beginning of his life was somewhat unusual. He was born to a single mom who most likely did not actually know who then Ted Bundy's actual father was. He was brought up originally believing that his grandparents were actually his parents. Later on, he learned in life that who his mother was and became enraged about the fact that she had lied to him. His birth certificate technically gave paternity to a salesman and Air Force veteran named Lloyd Marshall, but later his mother Louise claimed that she had been seduced by a sailor whose name may have been Jack Worthington. Years later, however, investigators would find no record of anyone by that name in the Navy or Merchant Marine archives at all. Some family members expressed suspicions, though, that Bundy may have actually been fathered by Louise's own violent, abusive father, which would have been his grandfather, named Sam Cowell. But no material evidence has ever been cited to support or refute this. So he lived his younger years with his grandparents. Later, he and his mother did move, and he was then somewhat raised by his stepfather, who he very much resented and did not get along with. After graduating from high school in 1965, Bundy spent a year at the University of Puget Sound before transferring to the University of Washington in 1966 to study Chinese, actually. What's interesting, I find, is that he was a very, very intelligent person. However, in 1967, he did become romantically involved with a University of Washington student who was identified in Bundy biographies by several pseudonyms, most commonly known, though, as Stephanie Brooks. This would actually be his first intimate relationship with another person. In early 68, though, he dropped out of college and worked at a series of minimum wage jobs. He was devastated when this girlfriend, Stephanie Brooks, broke up with him. He also volunteered at the Seattle office in Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign in August and attended the 1968 Republican National Convention in Miami as a Rockefeller delegate. He was absolutely devastated by Brooks's rejection. Bundy traveled then to Colorado and then farther east, visiting relatives in Arkansas and Philadelphia and enrolling for one semester at Temple University. This time in early 1969, Rule believes that Bundy visited the Office of Birth Records in Burlington and confirmed his true parentage. Again, becoming enraged. And like we said before, it's not even 100% sure that the man on his birth certificate is actually his father. It's at this time it is believed that he began his killing. There's no consensus on when or where Bundy actually began killing women. He did tell different stories to different people and refused to divulge the specifics of his earliest crimes, even as he confessed in graphic detail to dozens of later murders in the days preceding his execution, which would be in 1989. He told Nelson that he attempted his first kidnapping in 1969 in Ocean City, New New Jersey, but did not kill anyone until sometime in 1971 in Seattle. He did tell psychologist Art Norman, though, at one time that he did kill two women in Atlantic City in 1969 while visiting family in Philadelphia. To homicide detective Robert Keppel, he hinted at a murder in Seattle in 1972 and another in 73 involving a hitchhiker near Tumwater, Washington, but refused to elaborate. Rule and Keppel both believe that he may have started killing actually as early as a teenager, as circumstantial evidence suggests that he did abduct and killed an 8-year-old named Anne Marie Burr of Tacoma, Washington, way back in 1961 when he was only 14 years old. An allegation, though, he did deny repeatedly. His early documented homicides were committed in 1974 when he was 27 years old. By then, he had, by his own admission, mastered the necessary skills in the area before DNA profiling to leave minimal incriminating evidence at a crime scene. Ted Bundy was regarded by many of his young female victims as handsome and charismatic, traits that he exploited to win their trust. Other skills that he developed was that he would typically approach the female victims in public places. Very often he would feign injury. He might feign that he had a broken leg and be on crutches or his arm in a sling and not be able to get something into his car and therefore need help. He also, in some of the homicides, impersonated authority figures before he would then overpower and assault his victims. Sometimes he would actually revisit the crime scenes, which I understand is not unusual for serial killers, and at that point actually have sexual relations with their decomposing corpses. He decapitated at least 12 of the victims, and again, he has admitted to 30 actual murders. However, the amount is speculated to actually be higher than that. Like I said, he decapitated 12 of the victims, kept some of their severed heads actually in his apartment for periods of time as mementos, and a few occasions he simply broke into dwellings at night and bludgeoned his victims as they slept. Initially incarcerated in Utah in 1975. For aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault, Bundy became a suspect in a progressively longer list of unsolved homicides in multiple states. Facing further charges in Colorado, he engineered two dramatic escapes and committed further assaults, including three murders, before his ultimate recapture, in Florida in 1978. He received three death sentences in two separate trials for the Florida homicides. Later, he would be executed in the electric chair at Rayford Prison in Stark, Florida, and that occurred on January 24th, 1989.
Ted Bundy had a family outside of his immediate family. He also had a kid named Rose Bundy. Can you tell us, Ms. Coles, a little bit about his wife and how he married in the court, etc.?
Sure. It's unbelievable, actually, to think that he actually had a family and created this family while on death row, but that's exactly what he actually did. Ted Bundy did, in fact, marry. He married a woman named Carol Ann Boone, who he had met back in 1974 in Olympia, Washington, who he had worked with at the Department of Emergency Services. I'm gathering from the information I read about her that she kept contact with him or regained contact with him after she learned he was a serial killer and on trial. In fact, she traveled in 1980 to Orlando for his trial for the killing of the Chi Omega sorority girls, Margaret Bowman and Lisa Levy, where the serial killer acted in his own defense. Once again, he tried something extremely clever and realized through a loophole in Florida law that if he and a woman he wanted to marry, such as Carol Boone, were both in front of a judge and they declared themselves married while a judge was present, that in effect was as official as a marriage license. So during his trial, when he called Carol Ann Boone to the stand to be a character witness on his behalf, he just nonchalantly mentioned Carol and I are now something to the effect that Carol and I are now husband and wife, and nobody could do anything about it. They were now officially married. And she continued that then to see him and visit him in prison. While the Florida prison did not allow conjugal visits for death row inmates, it appears that Ted Bundy was able to bribe prison guards, which, as I read, was somewhat common during that time, and allow them this conjugal visit, which resulted in the birth of their daughter, Rose Bundy, in 1982. However, the marriage did not last all that long. In 1986, I believe it was, Carol Bundy now divorced Ted Bundy and left the state with her daughter Rose and a son from a previous marriage and never saw Ted again. To this day, not much is known about where Ted Bundy's wife and daughter reside. It's suspected that she changed her name in order to have privacy. And that's really all I know about that.
So is there anything that you disagree with in the case, whether it was from Bundy's side or the opposing side where they're trying to convict him of the murders? Anything like they shouldn't have let him choose to be his own lawyer, or that they should have put him up for not guilty by reason of insanity or anything like that?
I see what you're saying. There is nothing in the Constitution that states that you cannot be your own attorney. So that was his prerogative to choose to be his own attorney. While I don't think it was a very smart choice, I think he should have hired an attorney that most likely could have done a much better job for him. I feel he maybe could have been better represented by a skilled, seasoned attorney who could have perhaps proved more mitigating factors on his defense to avoid the death penalty. However, as we know, he chose to be his own attorney. Quite frankly, everything I've read about Ted Bundy and his desire to control and how intelligent he felt he was, it doesn't surprise me, though, that he was his own attorney. Again, that's his constitutional right, and that was his choice.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Coles. So I have a little fun fact. The term serial killer was not brought up until Bundy started killing people. They said that in the Netflix series Conversations with a Killer, which I thought was very interesting because there's been so many other serial killers before then, the earliest being Jack the Ripper, known as a notorious serial killer, though no one knows his true identity. Ted Bundy's court case was extremely odd in some cases. He refused to have a lawyer. Why did he refuse to have a lawyer, and why did he choose to become his own lawyer?
In my opinion, although I'm not an expert, it would speak to his narcissism, that he believed he was just that talented and for this series of a case could, you know, was able to defend himself. And even though he knew everything was stacked against him, I think he probably actually enjoyed taking center stage and once again trying to manipulate people during the trial and seem in control, because of course now that he was caught, he was not in control. And I think with a true narcissist, the objective is to always be in control, which is why I believe, anyway, he most likely acted as his own attorney.
And bringing up the term narcissist, this is my next question for Mr. Jensen. Mr. Jensen, what is a narcissist, and do you agree with the allegations of him being a narcissist?
Thanks for having me, Sarah, by the way.
No.
I think it's kind of hard to not have narcissistic personality disorder enter the picture here. You know, some of the characteristics are an inflated self-worth. That's definitely Bundy. That's Bundy on the trial, wanting to represent himself, not trusting other people to do as good a job as he could. Remember that in college, Ms. Coles mentioned that he studied Chinese, but he spent most of his time studying the law and psychology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, another characteristic of a narcissist is they have grandiose achievements, inflated status. Those would certainly fit Bundy. Narcissists don't practice what you'd call reciprocity. They don't give back in relationships what they get. That's not important to them. They have no empathy, certainly a Bundy characteristic. And then, of course, they didn't do this with Bundy, but you could look at brain scans, and you would see things like some structural abnormalities in the cerebral cortex. Your cortex would not light up when expressing empathy if you were a narcissist. Obviously something we didn't do with Bundy, but I kind of wish they would have, and we'd know your answer.
Yeah. So I briefly talked with you about possible mental disorders that Bundy could have had, and you brought up antisocial personality disorder. What is that, and why do you believe he had that?
Well, in 1975, Dr. Al Carlisle spent 20 hours talking to and analyzing Bundy in prison. And he's pretty certain that Bundy would be classified as someone with antisocial personality disorder. So with Carlisle, he says there are three processes that go into play here. One would be fantasy, a dark side, murderous fantasies. This is how the person would deal with painful memories, frustration, disappointment, perhaps being humiliated or bullied when they're young. They take on alternate identities when their normal life gets to be boring or they get angry enough, then they can slip into these fantasies. To do that, you also have a second point, which is dissociation. The brutal fantasy life can then develop into an addiction. If you mentally rehearse it enough and then you get the opportunity to act out on it, that might be what's happening here. And then the last part, the final part that Dr. Carlisle looked at was something he called compartmentalization. The brutal fantasy life from what is wrong in one situation becomes right in another. You compartmentalize your life so that in some instances you act normal, like Bundy, wanting to be a politician, wanting to take the lead in the community, and would not break laws. He did not have a long string of arrests. That really wasn't, he doesn't fit the pattern for some antisocial personality disorders. However, if you look at the definition, it's basically a total disregard for the feelings of others. There's no remorse. The main thing here is there's no conscience about it. You hurt people, you steal, you rob to the extreme, you kill. You may say you're sorry, you may apologize, but you don't feel it. These are generally, I think as Ms. Coles touched on, these people are generally at least average intelligence, perhaps a little more. It seems to affect about 1% of the population, but if you look at prisons, up to half of male prisoners could be or are diagnosed as antisocial personality disorders. He was, by the way, diagnosed with bipolar disorder during his trial. That's a mental disorder that's characterized by the highs of mania, not sleeping, talking excessively, acting excessively, followed by depression. Bipolar disorder can lead to psychosis and hallucinations, so that also could fit. So I don't think there's any real doubt that Bundy suffered from antisocial personality disorder, but we can't say that for sure because that's all speculation.
So, Mr. Jensen, we brought up antisocial personality disorder. You also brought up sadistic sociopath. What is that, and why did you bring that up?
Well, I think that with Bundy, and we talked about being a narcissist also, and I don't think there's any real doubt that he fits the qualifications. Also with antisocial personality disorder, although no one actually evaluated him enough to say for sure about that. But I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, we're talking about a sadistic sociopath. He took pleasure in others' pain. He enjoyed the fact that he had control over them. You know, even past death, he would come back and control their bodies, if you will, with his necrophilia and things like that. So I don't think there's any real doubt that Bundy is a classic sadistic sociopath. But he strongly rejected that, by the way. He did not believe he had any mental disorder.
Okay. I think I recall from the conversations with the killer, he thought that he was completely sane, and when they brought up the possibility of not guilty by reason of insanity, he was absolutely baffled by that, and thought it was an absolutely ridiculous assumption that he was in any way mentally not there.
Right.
Which I thought was kind of weird since he murdered people. So, do you think there was any reason Ted Bundy targeted college women that looked extremely similar?
I do. If you look at some of his early relationships, they were, I guess, obviously younger girls with long, brown hair. And many of his victims, an overwhelming majority of his victims, looked a lot like that. The first girl who basically broke his heart, I mean, that's a little simplistic, but it's something along those lines. He was definitely trying to fulfill some fantasies. And I think, again, you have to go to the dissociation in his mind. In his mind, he wasn't a killer, at least not all the time. He could justify that in his own mind because part of him was sane and acted rationally and could get along in society, and then he compartmentalized this whole other part of him that was a sadistic killer.
Do you believe that Ted Bundy should have pled not guilty by reason of insanity? Why or why not?
I think if he wanted to do what was best for Ted Bundy, he definitely would have gone for an insanity defense. But again, he wanted no part of that. He definitely thought he was not insane. He was insulted by the mere idea that he might be, just like he was insulted by the idea that he might not have been the best lawyer for himself. So I just think it was a route he couldn't take in his mind. And I think he enjoyed the limelight, the trial, everything, right up until he was convicted.
I agree with that. Okay, well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this episode of Dark History. We hope you enjoyed listening as much as we enjoyed recording it. Check out next time when we discuss the Chernobyl disaster. Thank you, Mr. Jensen and Mrs. Coles, for being here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We hope you have a great day. And remember, not only does history repeat itself, but also dark history repeats itself.